Thank you, Robert.
Okay, good morning. The group becomes ever smaller and ever more remote, ever more distant from me. But so today we will be talking about teams. Last week we discussed groups, and I will start today with making the differences or difference between groups and teams more explicit. But let's first get back to last week's questions. What are the 5 stages of group development? And I'm not reading them all. What would be the correct answer? Moritz.
C.
Forming, storming, norming, performing, and adjoining. Who knows the name of the author who developed the 5-stage model of group development? Who was this? What's the name of the model? Sorry? It's a 5-stage model, and who was the author who developed it? Tuckman, yeah. What was the other model that we discussed that I briefly showed you for groups that are not permanent groups or groups with a longer lifetime but short-term project teams? Frau Tuckton. Anyone know the name? It's a punctuated equilibrium model, which means there are 2 stages of equilibria, and in the middle you have this punctuated phase of hectic activity, and you have another punctual phase of hectic activity at the end, and hopefully everything goes well. And this was developed by Connie Gersick. Which of the following terms refer to the process by which an individual's desire for acceptance by the group and the pressure by the group on the individual members to match its standards result in a change in individual attitudes and behavior? Conformity, commitment, confluence, coercion, or conversion? Yes, please. It's conformity. So the group may exert some coercion, but we see that even without any coercion, people feel that there is some pressure for complying to the group's norms and standards, and the group's desire to be accepted by the group and not excluded leads to conformity, which often is public opinion change, but not comes with private change in one's attitudes or behaviors. Which of the following terms indicates the degree to which group members are attracted to one another and are motivated to stay in the group? Reliability, cohesiveness, interdependence, integration, or sociability? Yeah, Frau Tuckton? It's B, cohesiveness. And as I mentioned, cohesion is an important term in social psychology and in organizational behavior, and typically we see that cohesive groups are also better functioning groups, both in terms of productivity, performance, and individual team members' job satisfaction. And it's very close to the concepts of organizational commitment or organizational identification, but the operationalization is typically very different. So we have discussed how we measure commitment and identification in week 2 or 3 when we discuss job attitudes. Typically, you ask individuals about their individual level of their bond between themselves as a person and the organization in which they are a member of. Cohesion would typically be measured by providing every team member a list of all other team members and then asking them to which team members they have particularly close relationships and which team members they like. And the more the team members then rate each other as likable, the more cohesive a group would be. Any questions from last week? Anything you always wanted to know? Okay, so we are already halfway through our program. And we follow up on what we discussed last week, and I start with contrasting teams that we discussed today from groups that we analyzed last week. We compare and contrast four different types of groups and teams. We identify characteristics of effective teams, show how organizations can create team players, decide when to use individuals instead of teams, and at the end of the lecture, we also briefly talk about the global context and how this affects our understanding of teams and teamwork. But first, why are teams so popular? Why do organizations more and more work in teams? First, there's an increased competition that forces organizations to restructure to become more efficient and more effective. I think I mentioned in the very first week that so many things cannot be done alone, and therefore teams are more necessary today in a more complex service environment than they have been traditionally when we mostly worked in manufacturing companies on the assembly line. But teams also better utilize employee talents, or they can utilize employee talents in a better way if managed well. Teams are typically more flexible and also more responsive to change than individuals because teams provide the individuals collective self-efficacy beliefs, and this helps them dealing with change and reducing uncertainties more than individuals, than when we work in individual formats. And they democratize and motivate people. Typically, participation and job involvement happens in teams. We have circles of employee or work. We have work councils. We have circles of teams that translate change into action, like change management teams. But also, if a team leader encourages a team to participate in a decision making about smaller things, it's easier done in teams than when the team leader approaches individuals who often do not dare to say something because they feel that they may lack the skills, or they don't want to participate, or they lack the skills indeed. And if this participation happens in teams, then it's more likely that the outcome will be positive. Okay, now what distinguishes a group from a team? The formal definitions or the formal characterizations are that work groups are groups who interact primarily to share information, to make decisions, to help one another perform within each member's area of responsibility, whereas a team generates synergy through coordinated effort, and the individual efforts result in a level of performance that is greater than the sum of those individual inputs. As an example, maybe think of social psychology department as a group, and for example, when we talk about teaching, we have three or four lecturers, Alina Hernandez and Sebastian Stegmann and Stefan Braun and Diana Böhr, who teach in the psychology bachelor module social psychology, and each one of them is lecturing one seminar. And sometimes they align, they form a group, they share information, for example, about the exam procedures. So they align their way of teaching and conducting the exam. However, there is relatively very little synergy. The individual teaching styles do not change because they exchange some information. The accountability is still purely on the individual level. It's the individual lecturers who receive teaching evaluations. It's the individual lecturers who receive feedback, positive and negative, from students who are happy or less happy with the lectures. And the skills are relatively random and varied. You all know that lecturers differ in style and lecturing quality, and it's random whether you as a student end up teaching with one or being taught by one lecturer than by another one, and it's relatively random how these lecturers are distributed across modules. However, when we form a work team, when we form a real team, this looks different. For example, when the four people, Alina and Sebastian and the others, write a paper together. When they write a paper together, they align their skills to be complementary. So the one who is the most skilled person in writing theoretical parts and reading the literature will start with developing the hypothesis. Another one who is probably most apt in the method section or the results section and does all the analysis writes this section of a paper. And the third one may be most appropriate in communicating with the editor and shaping the paper in a way that it is attractive to the potential audience. Mm. So here they align their skills so that they are not random and varied. It wouldn't make little sense to roll a dice and then to assign three or four people who co-author a paper a role and said we randomly assign who writes a theory part, who writes a methods part, and who does the discussion and the references. But the people align their skills so that they utilize them in a complementary way. The accountability here in teams is both individual and mutual. Individually, of course, the one co-author who has written the results part is accountable for writing a correct results part and coming up with the correct analyses and a presentation of these analyses. However, the team is also mutually accountable for the whole paper, and they receive feedback from the journal or from an editor as a team and not individually. The editor would not normally say, I reject your paper because co-author A has written a poor theory part, but the team as such is mutually accountable for the end result, and therefore everyone has to contribute to it. Ideally, we have positive synergy. Because of the complementary skills and its alignment, the end result, the paper, will be better than if either one starts to write their own paper. And the goal is collective performance. So here the goal is, yes, we share information, but then individually we each go into our lecture theater and then we deliver our teaching. Here the goal is we have to write to create one piece of work that we collectively generate and submit to a journal. Okay, I think with this example it becomes more clear what a team is and what a group is, but in reality, in practice, of course, we have often we have something in between, or we have teams that sometimes act like groups, and sometimes we have groups that act like teams in for certain tasks, for certain purposes, and as you've seen from my example, the social psychology group is a group or a team, but for some tasks we work together, we have a shared goal, we work together interdependently, and we interact with each other face to face to achieve this goal, and then we would talk of a team. And for other tasks, we are more like a group. We can differentiate between four main types of teams. And again, these teams may overlap, or these types of teams may overlap to some degree. We have problem-solving teams, self-managed teams, cross-functional teams, or virtual teams. And sometimes we can have a virtual problem-solving team that is self-managed and cross-functional. But these are the four main types that we can differentiate and look at when we want to analyze a team and the team's processes. Okay. Problem-solving teams are often from the same department. They share ideas or suggest improvements, but they are rarely given authority to implement any of their suggested actions. So we can, for example, discuss as a group of social psychologists lecturing in the bachelor and BSc6 module, we can think about improvements. And we may think about changing the exam structure. But we don't have the authority to implement the change because this needs to be done by the Fachbereichsrat, by the department. Or it has to be implemented through a more or less extensive accreditation and reaccreditation process. Sometimes groups get together to solve a problem, and the group's task is to come up with one or two suggestions, but then it's a team leader's responsibility to decide which of the suggestions to implement, and sometimes the team leader needs to present it to higher management and ask them for resources to be able to implement it. Self-managed work teams are anything between 10 to 15, but sometimes also more, sometimes less, employees in highly related jobs. And the team takes on some of the supervisory responsibility related to work planning, scheduling, assigning tasks, operating decisions, working with customers, for example. They sometimes also select and evaluate their own team members. Whether they are effective or not is dependent on the situation, on the context, on the specific type of task. So I think you all have a picture in your mind about how an assembly line in the automotive industry looks. So there's a linear assembly line on which workers individually contribute to the car in their areas of specialization and specific skills. But modern assembly lines look completely different. Some 10 years ago, I was visiting a BMW plant in England, and you don't see an assembly line at all. You have a number of roboters that move the car or the body of the car from one station to the other, and around these stations you have self-managed work teams who decide on their own how they complete their tasks, how they complete their work. At the moment we are having a little project with the VGF here in Frankfurt, the Verkehrsbetriebe. They have workshops where they repair the trains. And typically it's not a self-managed work team, so the train gets in, and then a team of an engineer, an electrician, carpenter, or whatever you may need to repair the train gets together and decides who starts with what task and what can be done in which sequence, etc. But the train comes in, and whichever group has time first, and may be the carpenters or may be the electricians, they get into the train, and then the train sits there and waits until the next group is available, and so on. And we suggested new ways of doing it together and have a team of one engineer and one carpenter and one electrician, etc., and have them assess what needs to be done and then work on it as a group. And we think that this is a faster and probably also better, particularly when the group is also held accountable for getting the train out of the workshop at a certain time or date. And B, it's more motivating. It should be more motivating to work on a train as a whole and not only doing a small piece on the repair that needs to be done on one train in the morning and on the next train in the afternoon and then on the next train in the next morning again, and never see the train coming in and leaving the workshop. Remember, we talked about skill variety, we talked about task identity, we talked about meaningfulness, and we think that designing the job around self-managed teams might help seeing the whole piece and seeing the meaningfulness of one's own contribution to the train getting repaired. Okay. Cross-functional teams are members from the often or mostly members from the same level but diverse areas within and between organizations. For example, when we install a master's committee, when we introduced our master's, we had a committee comprising professors from all the areas of psychology that were all on the same level. But we also had a few student representatives. We had a person from the exam office. And they came together to exchange information, develop new ideas, solve problems in the creation of the master's program. they had to coordinate a very complex project. I think we started developing the master's project in 2007 when I started working here in Frankfurt, and we completed it in 2009 and got our master's program to the accreditation process to start with the first cohort in 2011. So it was a 4 or 5 year process in which this group very frequently met. So we had like at least 2 or 3 meetings per semester, and it was a complex problem to solve, and we had to exchange a lot of information. So it was time consuming because it was a complex problem. And the diversity of the team member led to some conflicts and time-consuming discussions we had, but ultimately, of course, made the solution we developed, our master program, better than if only a small group without, for example, the input of the student representatives or the people from the exam board would have produced. Okay? So, and as I said, sometimes you have problem-solving teams which are cross-functional. Sometimes you have a self-managed work team that is cross-functional. Sometimes you have a cross-functional team who is self-managing, sometimes not. So, for example, we have some committees where I, as a dean, are the chair or the head of the committee per definition. For example, the PhD exam board, that's a committee that is cross-functional because there also we have professors from various areas, plus student representatives, plus representatives from the PhD students. But it's not a self-managed team because I, as a dean, chair this meeting and I have a clear agenda and it's based on clear rules and regulations. Whereas this master committee was more self-managed teams where we assigned different roles and where the team itself could decide how they would work together, etc. And sometimes, and this is the last element of teamwork, sometimes we do our work in teams in a virtual way where people are dispersed geographically or regionally, or some people work on, for example, some human geography is on the in the PEG on the campus West End, and the rest of geography belongs to the Department of Geography and Geology, and they are residing on the Riedberg. So when they want to align teaching questions, when they have groups or committees that deal with certain problems, sometimes they are dispersed and work together virtually by telephone, by video conferencing, with email facilities or shared workstations where you work on Word documents or Excel tables from various locations. There's, of course, in these geographically dispersed teams or virtual teams in general, less social rapport. The people don't see each other so much, and even if they see each other via video conference, there's less direct feedback from the others. Gestures and mood and so on. These teams are typically more task-oriented, so it's less likely that these teams will focus on a lot on social interactions and group harmony, etc. And the team members are often less satisfied with the teamwork. So managers need to find ways of organizing and managing virtual teams well. You can imagine, for example, that identification in virtual teams is lower than in face-to-face groups. And this has been found in some research. But we can utilize new technology to make this less of a problem. That's so lustig. So how can you imagine to utilize technology to make virtual teams less of a problem related to identification, cohesiveness? What would you do if you would create a virtual team? Say you had to chair a student committee from students of various universities, Berlin, Munich, Hamburg, and it's unlikely that you meet once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone use Skype with like four or five people together? But it worked with several people that...
It worked with several people, several countries, over several... It's really great.
Thanks.
And some friends and me were going to establish a union.
A union?
Yeah.
A student union?
A sort of student union. Ah. For students of Turkish background.
Ah. So technology helps establishing virtual teams, and for some tasks, virtual teams are necessary because otherwise, the tasks or the goals could not be accomplished. There's one paper by Milbert, Postmus, and Alex Heslam, and they indeed found in an organization where there was hot desking that there was lower identification of the individual team members. However, in some teams, they had extensive use of electronic media, and they made sure that sometimes there was face-to-face interaction, like once a year on a Christmas party or something like this. And in these teams, identification was not lower than regularly or normally. But as managers, we have to think about this. And often managers don't think about this. So salespeople, this is a typical context where you have more or less like a virtual team. So you have 10 salespeople dispersed in 10 different geographical regions in Germany, and each of the salespeople know their supervisor and know what the supervisor wants them to achieve, and they may know the higher objectives of the organization as such. But then when there's never face-to-face meetings and when they cannot communicate to one another by email or by video conferencing, then the low frequency of interaction leads to lower cohesion and commitment. Now, I think we will certainly see more of technology advancement in the future, but we also, for example, at the university, we have sometimes used video conferencing to have job interviews with prospective professors. And sometimes this works well, particularly when the candidate is from the US and we save a lot of travel time and money to bring the candidate over just for half an hour of presentation and questions of answers. But sometimes it also does not work so well. So I, for example, was on Skype for PhD examinations twice, once in Vienna and once in Canada. And it's really, really exhausting to be on the telephone for 2 hours and listen to four or five people that are in the room, and then you have background noise and all this. So you can do that for some time, but if you do it for an hour or 2 hours, and if you would only have these types of meetings, then it can be exhausting and also distracting. I would like to talk about three different components that make teams more or less effective: context, composition, and process. And I would like to show you a little video from Michael West and his teams. I told you about their NHS research in the UK. And they also consult hospitals to introduce teamwork. And this is a video that was produced by the research team as one example of how the teamwork was introduced in a positive and well-thought manner. And I would like you to just watch it for a few minutes and take some notes. And please pay attention to particularly the context in which this teamwork is operating, the composition of the teams, and the processes that they utilize.
Team working is another HR management practice the Aston research showed is strongly related to lower patient mortality. Together, South Devon Healthcare Trust and Torbay PCT are transforming their organisations around team working. It's only been running for a year, but already differences have been seen in how staff work together and patients have noticed improvements in care. So far, over 100 teams have been involved, but within 2 years, all teams will have taken part in the development programme.
When Aston asked us to look at team-based working, it certainly rang a bell. It really struck a chord with us. Any organisation, particularly one like the National Health Service or a trust, has got areas that don't work so well and areas that really work very well. And you look in our trust at some of the things that worked very well. And they were teams. They were teams in the kind of definition that Aston set. Take one example, which would be midwifery. We were told some years ago that we had to deliver the agenda of changing childbirth, which is all about patient choice and increasing the amount of childbirth that's done at home, much more patient-focused care. This hospital's answer, this trust's answer, was to go over to team-based midwifery, so that there are distinct midwifery teams that work with patients. It has been an outstanding success. And a beacon, and the people who are working in teams are energized, they're producing a very good service, they're bringing in innovation all the time. The patients love it, we've got a higher percentage of home births than any other trust in the country, and it's based on teams.
There are some cynical and rightly skeptical people. Who say, where is the evidence that this makes a difference? There is some research and evidence from other types of industry, but very little from healthcare. Getting quantitative evidence of the benefits of this program is actually very difficult. So I set out to get some quantitative evidence. I sent a questionnaire around to all of those people who've been through the program and got some very interesting results, some very positive and some less so. And then I went to interview some particular teams to see what they've done with the program. And there are some very encouraging stories about what teams have done who started from quite a difficult position, some of them, with poor management arrangements, poor leadership, and a team which was so focused on doing its work that it never had time to stop and think and plan its work better. Well, I think you have to resource it, first of all, if people are. You have to make sure that if people are giving up their time to do this, and this is particularly some primary care where people are running independent businesses, that on occasions that you reimburse them for that time, first of all. Secondly, I think you have to respond to the things that you're being told. You know, people say, well, actually, we think that the way you're organised as a PCT isn't helping us as a team do what we need to do. You have to think about that. And show that you're prepared to respond to that. And thirdly, I think you have to show that it's not just a fad. This isn't just yet another improvement project that's going to come in, get everybody excited for 6 months, and then gradually disappear into the sand. I think you have to show that you're committed to integrating this way of working into your organisation over time. It needs the team leaders who are helpful and allow the process to be taken on by the facilitators, and it needs facilitated managers in the background making it happen by providing the resources that they need. And there are teams within this organisation that have done that with really powerful effect, making small changes to where they work so that things now get done better, they discuss things better, they make decisions which they never made before, and it has allow them to prioritise their time better so that the right patients are being seen by them and that the quality of the interactions that they make with patients are very much better than they used to be. We haven't linked it to people's individual performance appraisal, because actually I don't think it is about that as much as saying to groups of people, there are simple techniques which we believe are easily learnable that you can then use as a team to help think about setting your own objectives and gaining for yourselves more control over the work that you do. And there's a challenge in that to the way in which you manage the organisation, because if you're saying that, then you have to be serious about devolving authority to people who want to take it on. And we've had to think about some of the things some of the ways we were organising the PCT to try and get more devolution to frontline teams.
Well, in any organisation, change is threatening, and doing it the way it's always been done is always the best thing. So change in itself is a challenge. And at the moment, the National Health Service has been bombarded more and more and more with change. You've got to modernise, you've got to change. And I think one of the problems with bringing in team-based working, when we are bringing in, is people see it, oh no, not another change, and we've got change fatigue. What we really need to do is turn that around and say, no, this isn't change in the sense that you've got to do things differently because that's what you're being told to do. What we want to do is to say to people, look, here is a tool, here is a way of doing things which will help you with the other change. Getting that message across, I think, that team-based working isn't another burden and imposition, it's actually a help. And I think we're beginning to get there. People are saying, wow, I actually achieved something that I'd taken years to try and achieve, and achieved it much more easily using a team.
Okay, we will talk about organizational change in a couple of weeks. And I think that the last statement is quite an important one, making clear to people that when you introduce teamwork in organizations, it's not a change in itself, but teamwork is changing the organization structure so that the organization's members can cope with other types of change in a much better way. Did you find interesting or important? Remember, I told you that in hospitals in which more percentage of staff are working in teams, patient mortality is lower. So whenever you are ill in England, go to South Devon Healthcare Trust in Torbay, because they do team working and the likelihood that you will survive an operation is maybe a little bit higher. What was interesting to you? Yes, please. Yeah, I think it's interesting to have a manager say we wanted to get evidence, and when he said that, okay, there is evidence that teamwork might be effective in other sectors, but there's little evidence in healthcare, because when this video was made, the study about the patient mortality teamwork link was not yet done. And therefore, they did what a good manager should do. So let's get the evidence ourselves. And let's try to get quantitative evidence by sending around a questionnaire and then finding teams that work particularly well and teams that may not work so well yet. And then let's compare the findings by doing interviews with the people involved and getting best practice models, etc. So I think this, maybe the Aston group or maybe the hospital was very proactive in this way, but this is an ideal manager. An ideal manager would say, to convince our people, it's best to produce some evidence. And if the evidence is not yet there in the literature or in research, then let's do the research ourselves and get this evidence. Mm-hmm. Thank you. What else did you notice that might be important? What was the first thing the CEO said? What would you care about when you were a CEO? What would be the first question you would ask? and you were CEO of a team, an organization, a hospital or whatever, and then a consultant would come in and would say, you have to restructure your whole hospital, it would be much better to introduce teamwork. What would a CEO typically ask? What would you do if you were a CEO? Yeah, certainly. If I were a CEO, I would first ask how much does it cost, and how much may it bring back to me. So the first thing he said was, you have to resource it. So you have to acknowledge, as senior managers in an organization that introduces teamwork, that it will not be for free, because it needs trainers who try to set up the teams and who teach the team members to be more efficient, etc. We will discuss about this. You maybe for some time need more staff, more people. You have to give the teams budgets or whatever if you want to have teams who can participate in decision making and decide what to do, etc. And this CEO apparently was aware of this and provided these resources. What else? Did you find anything surprising?
Yeah. There was one, I don't know whom of the guys or in which position he was, said that it was actually hindering the team effectiveness that they focused too much on work, mm-hmm. as far as I understood. So that is something what I think maybe is surprising also for them, mm-hmm. being in a manager's position, because of course your focus is much on the work yeah. and not so much maybe yeah. on individual team members or how they interact, so mm-hmm. that they might have also realized that they need to give certain possibilities for them to socially interact together mm-hmm. by, and I think that is what he mentioned then, setting their objectives together. Mm-hmm. and setting goals and also mm-hmm. together achieving those so that they can see it's more working together effectively than reaching certain or doing a certain task mm-hmm. per person.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is a very important observation because it's linked to one of Michael West's core research topics, which is team reflexivity. So often teams think that they have to get the job done, and this is the first and foremost task they do, and they focus so much of getting the job done that they never can stand a step back and think about, are we still doing the right job? Is our task the right? Are the processes that we have to getting the job done, are it still the right processes, or can we probably improve? And Michael West suggests that teams should have these phases of team reflexivity regularly. So in our department, for example, we started a year ago or 2 years ago with having regular retreats. And we call them teaching retreats or research retreats, where we meet once a semester and then we discuss certain topics to think about how we can improve teaching as a group, as an institute of psychology, teaching stuff. And not only constantly thinking about, oh, when do I have to submit the next module and when do I have to complete all the exams, etc. Because this keeps us so busy that we never think about, but are we still doing the right things? And it was interesting here, even in a hospital where team-based working is introduced for the first time, then after some time, I don't think it has been more than a year to send out this first survey to get quantitative evidence about how well the team-based working was functioning. Even in a hospital that with a lot of consulting from experts, team-based working is introduced for the first time, there are some teams that still don't have this freedom or degrees of freedom for being reflective on what they actually do. Anything else? It's a very complex process. So Michael West talks about about 2 years that are needed to fully introduce team-based working from the start to the finish. And so organizations need to accept that it takes time, that it costs some money, but it is good also to ask for the evidence that helps organizations making the point at senior management level, but then also when introducing the team-based working to the lower levels in the hierarchy, why people should do it. And I think for the individual, it's important to understand that teams are a tool that helps them coping with difficult tasks rather than being a burden. So some of these things were mentioned in the interview, or we discussed them. The presence of adequate resources is an important thing. Effective leadership was also briefly mentioned in one of the interviews. In the teams, you need a climate of trust. This is something Michael West and other colleagues have found in their research, particularly on innovation. Innovation happens in teams where you have a so-called high safety culture or safety climate, and not safety in relation to workplace security, but safety in relation to trusting each other, that we can try out things, and if they don't work well, then we are not penalized. The performance evaluation and reward system that reflects team contributions. The CEO said, we have not linked it to individual team members' performance appraisals, which I think is a problem. When you introduce team-based working, then you should not only link individuals' salary or bonuses to individual performance. You should link it also to team performance, because this is the ultimate goal of getting people together in teams, that the team together achieves their goals and aims. Sometimes it's good to leave a component of individual performance in the whole package of performance appraisal, but I think it is not perfectly thought through or not perfect to not at least also consider team contributions as a key determinant of individual performance appraisals. Did any one of you ever work in a context where team outcomes were predicting individuals' bonus, for example? Does anyone have an example? Yes, please. Okay. Yeah. So it's a combination of achieving the individual goals and achieving the team goals. And so when everyone works well as an individual, they receive a bonus. But if they act well as a group member and have the group achieving their own, they also benefit from it. Or they would suffer if the team would not work so well. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, please. Okay, yeah, thank you. And the prize itself, winning, is a bonus that you can only get when the team as a whole wins the competition and does what they are supposed to do. Yeah. Okay. This is very important. I think many organizations make big mistakes here. So they introduce teamwork, but they still pay their individuals purely based on individual performance. And this then, remember last week we talked about social loafing, for example. If the group is not important to me, because the group outcome is not in any way related to what I earn or what benefits I may get, then I may engage in social loafing when it's about tasks within the team that seem less important to my own outcomes or my own goals. Other factors, so this was contextual components, what that the organization as such can do to create a context that makes teamwork more effective. And then within the team, of course, you also have factors that contribute to more or less effectiveness. For example, team composition. Which team members belong to the team and what are their abilities, for example, in relation to technical expertise or other skills. But also, team members need more than just the technical skills to get their job done. As soon as you organize work around teams, you also need team members who have problem-solving abilities and interpersonal skills. We all know some people who are not the best team players because of their personality, because of a lack of interpersonal skills, because of a high tolerance for conflict, which other people may not share, etc. Conscientiousness is always a good factor that contributes to high performance and also in teams. And people need to be open-minded. So these seem to be the two factors of the big five personality that are related to good teamwork. Conscientiousness, because it's always related to good performance, but open-mindedness seems to be the one factor within teamwork that contributes to teams working more effectively together. You have a clear need to have a clear allocation of roles. Leadership, for example, you can have shared leadership in teams, but it should be clearly allocated who is responsible for what. The size of the teams is a very important factor, and it seems that there is a negative relationship between team size and some of potential team outcomes. My own basic, very rough suggestion is have 7 ± 2 team members and not more. I mentioned this last week, but if you need fewer members, then a smaller team is always better than a larger team. Sometimes, as in football or in other situations, we need 11 or more players to achieve the goal. And let's talk about diversity a little bit in more detail. There's now about 50 years of diversity research, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of studies that looked at the effect of diversity. Various studies that looked at objective diversity in terms of surface diversity. Surface diversity is, for example, diversity of team members in terms of gender, age, ethnic background. Functional background would also count as a surface factor when everyone is aware of the functional background of the team members. So when we form a team, a cross-disciplinary team for the master's accreditation, we all know, of course, that I'm the social psychologist, my colleague is a developmental psychologist, and the third colleague is a clinical psychologist. So in this respect, it would be also a surface factor. And then there are deep-level factors of diversity, such as people's personality, people's attitudes, value systems, people's prior experiences, etc. And all this research over more than 50 years has not found clear effects. So even meta-analyses with 100 or 200 studies in the area of gender and performance or in the area of ethnicity and performance has not found clear positive or negative effects. Typically, the average effect in all the meta-analyses that I know is around zero. That means diversity, on average, does not have a large effect in either direction, but there are individual studies that show that diversity can have very negative effects. And studies that showed us that diversity can have very positive effects. Whenever you have this situation, as a good psychologist, you should ask about moderating factors. Which are the contingencies, which are the boundary conditions that help us determine when diversity has positive and when diversity has negative effect? But by and large, if you are asked by an organization, is diversity good, or if you are hearing someone say or reading a story in the media saying that diversity is always good, you should say, no, this is not the case, unfortunately. And I do some work with some colleagues in our group on gender and leadership, And I would hope that I could say in some panel discussions or so that it is always good to bring more women in, into teams. But this is not the case. The latest meta-analyses of 100 studies looking explicitly at gender and performance does not say that the more women or the more balance between men and women leads to higher performance. Women may have other advantages if participating in decision-making, but not necessarily with performance effects. For example, you know that Norway has introduced a strict quota for women in the advisory boards of organizations some 7-8 years ago, and they have quickly achieved this target then, with now 40% of all boards comprising women, at least 40%. And I only recently read a paper in The Economist saying that, or demonstrating with clear data, that that doesn't help anything on the next and probably even more important level of the organization's hierarchy, the board of top managers. And in Norway, there are not more female top managers and CEOs than in any other country. So having women in the advisory boards, which, as you know, we are currently doing in Germany, last month there was this decision that we also have a strict quota from next year on, does not necessarily help to bring more women in top management. A group of economists from Chicago University looked at the financial performance of companies in Norway that had more female women on the advisory boards earlier on, when the strict quota was not yet in practice. And they found that the more women were on the advisory board of these companies, the lower was the company's financial performance. That means women may contribute to lower profits. However, when you look a little bit more closely into this study, you will see that this study was conducted between 2007 and 2009. This was at the financial crisis. And one factor that contributed to the negative relationship between the proportion of women on top and the lower financial performance was that companies with more women on top were not laying off people so easily. So women kept their employees because they felt responsible for them, or maybe because they felt responsible for them. It was not explored in this research by The Economist. And this first may be a good thing in and of itself. Sometimes it's better to not lay off people just to make profit, because it's a morally good thing to do. But it may also end up to be a financially good thing, because right after the financial crisis was over in many countries, people were desperately looked for by the organizations. And if I was just fired by my organization, I would probably first look to get a job elsewhere when the job market is starting again. In Germany, for example, we have an instrument called Kurzarbeit, short work. Short labor? Low? I don't know. Kurzarbeit means that when the company is having severe financial difficulties, they can say, okay, we take a number of our workforce and have them work not for 40 hours per week, but for, say, 10 or 20 hours per week. And they are paid a little bit less, but receive about two-thirds of their typical salary. But half of this salary is paid by the government and not by the organization. So this helps people staying into work and staying with the organization. And this is an instrument that is helpful for a short period of time. Say, when the organization says, we need this instrument for the next 6 months, we are hopeful that the market is asking for our products again next summer or so. And some economists have said that this instrument of the Kurzarbeit has contributed to Germany overcoming the financial crisis a little faster than some other countries. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. I think the sustainability that we got is much more relevant than turnover or like
So, from diversity to Kurzarbeit, and back to diversity again. So diversity can have positive and negative effects, and overall, on average, the effects are closer to zero than to anything else. And especially Dan van Knippenberg had looked at these moderating factors, and together with Carsten Edreu and Astrid Hohmann, they developed a model, the categorization elaboration model of diversity, that helps us understand why diversity may have positive or negative effects. And then they did also some research, and one research project we did together, and I will show you in a moment, was testing the assumptions of this model. So we know, and I told you multiple times, that identification is a key variable for organizations and groups' success. The basis for categorization in all humans is similarity. We like people who are similar to us more than we like people who are very dissimilar. Therefore, if we have homogeneous groups, it's more likely that the team is cohesive and that we identify with these teams. If a team is heterogeneous, then it's more likely that there will be subcategories and subgroups. So if I have a team that is comprising five people and two of them are female and three are male, or two are old and three are young, the likelihood is high that there will be conflicts between, because the group members will not perceive themselves as one unity, which they can strongly identify, but they see themselves as members of different subgroups, and there's a higher likelihood for conflict. However, we know that diversity can be good for some tasks. So we know that diversity is good when I have complex problems to solve and I can draw on the different, diverse team members' different levels of expertise. That's why we form these cross-functional teams, because we assume that the diversity of the team members will contribute to better solutions. So Dan van Knippenberg's idea was that diversity beliefs should help us utilizing the benefits of diversity and putting the risks or downsides of diversity aside by incorporating the diversity into the team's identity as a good team. And we can establish this, for example, through ideology. We can tell people that diversity is good for moral reasons or for other reasons. In the 1970s in Germany, the workers' unions, the employees' unions, the big unions established an ideology that foreign workers or employees with different ethnic backgrounds are good colleagues. In German, that was Mein Kumpel ist ein Ausländer. It was a big campaign by the Deutsche Gewerkschaftsbund in the 1970s, which helped a little overcoming prejudice and discrimination. But also through expectations of performance. So telling people up front why diversity may be a good thing for the task that they have to solve or resolve can help people forming a positive diversity belief. And the basic hypothesis is that diversity beliefs are beliefs about the value of diversity or homogeneity that can determine the extent to which diversity is seen as something that is or should be part of the group's identity. And when I say, or when I perceive that diversity is part of my group's identity as a well-performing, as a good group, then I benefit from it. And people can either hold pro-diversity or pro-similarity beliefs. And the hypothesis is that these diversity beliefs then are the key moderator that decides whether diversity leads to more positive or more negative outcomes. And this is a categorization elaboration model by van Knippenberg et al. In more detail. So diversity is linked to group performance in this model via the mediator of information elaboration. When I have more diversity in a team, then I have more diverse perspectives, I have more information, I have probably more creativity. And when this information is utilized, then the outcome will be more positive. However, whether diversity leads to a higher information elaboration depends on the task characteristics. Is there a job to be done that requires multiple perspectives, more information, deep full thought, or is it a routine task where homogeneity is probably better than heterogeneity? And people's effective reactions. If people like it, then they translate diversity into more information elaboration and then higher performance results. If people don't like it, then diversity will not lead to more information elaboration. And whether the effective reaction is positive or negative depends on the categorization process. And we tested this part of the model. So we wanted to see whether diversity leads to more categorization and this leads to effective reactions. And we tested this by asking team members about their perceived diversity. So do they categorize the team as diverse or not? And the effective reaction was measured by identification. And then we wanted to see whether people's individual beliefs about heterogeneity being good or bad for their context would moderate the relationship between diversity and identification. Yeah, and we expected a less negative or even a positive relationship between diversity and identification for individuals with a pro-diversity belief system. We conducted two studies, and I only show you one of them, at Aspen in a master's and MBA program, where we had 70% students being not born in the UK. So very different from Germany, the majority of students in a UK university classroom are not British. How is it in China? Are you from China? Yeah. Are there many non-Chinese students at a Chinese university in, for example, MBA programs? In a class of 100 or more or less?
Yeah, more than 100.
More than 100. So the proportion of foreign students is very low. And I think this is the same in Germany. In an executive MBA class, that may be different. But in a psychology class, this is something like the exception from the rule. I think on average, we have 2% foreign students in our psychology classes. Okay, at Aspen it's different. We have many different people from all over the world. We had Chinese students, we had students from India, students from Greece, Spain, etc., etc. We had 2 points of measurements, and at the first questionnaire, in the first week of the program, we asked people for their diversity beliefs. So they didn't know their team members yet, which was important. We wanted to know how do they think about diversity without thinking of the individual team member they are working with. And one question was, being in a heterogeneous group is an advantage for completing our task. So they knew that they were working together in small groups of 5 or 6 students for the next 7 or 8 weeks, and that their task was to give a presentation on a case study analysis, and that this presentation was graded, and the grade contributed 25% or 50% to their overall grade. So they knew that this was an important group with important outcomes. And we asked them, to what extent do you think heterogeneity is good for achieving their outcomes or achieving their goals? And 7 weeks later, when they had worked in the team for several weeks, we asked them about subjectively perceived diversity. How diverse do you think your syndicate group is? And then we had some questions about general diversity, and we had some specific questions about ethnic diversity. And we measured their identification with the team. Do you identify or not with 4 items? We analyzed this on with multi-level analyses because we had people in groups. And what we found was that objective diversity was related to to identification negatively. Subjective diversity was also negatively related to identification. So here we have evidence of this categorization conflict part of the categorization elaboration model. The more heterogeneity, the less likely people tended to identify with diverse teams. But we also, and this was most important, we also found a moderated effect of subjective diversity by diversity beliefs. And this looked, in the first study, it looked like this. When team members had low diversity beliefs or diversity beliefs that were pro-homogeneity, we found a negative relationship between diversity and group identification. So the more diverse people perceived their groups to be, the least they identified with it when they thought that homogeneity was better for performing. When they believed that heterogeneity was good for their performance, we didn't find a significant relationship anymore. It was still negative, but it was not significant anymore. In the second study, we found a slightly different pattern. We found that this line was positive and significant, where the other line was not significant anymore and only marginally negative. But our hypothesis was confirmed. As soon as people start thinking about diversity as being helpful for the group performance, they can integrate the team diversity into what they think makes a group a good group, and then they identify with it. And the identification helps with accomplishing the team's aims, with being more satisfied, etc. Any questions to this study or diversity in general? No question. Who thought that diversity was good before this lecture? Who is disappointed now? Yeah, I'm sorry that I cannot tell you better news. And as I said, I would be more than happy to be able to telling other stories. For example, on the question of the female proportion or number of female executives on performance outcomes, there's a lot you will find in the media, but there's not a single good empirical study that confirms this story in the media. There are some studies by Boston Consulting Group or by McKinsey that suggest that more women on board are better for the organizations. And I'm happy to believe that this is true, but I haven't seen the evidence yet. And when I look at the meta-analyses, and this is the best we can do as academics, unfortunately the average effect is zero. But this tells us that we can do something as managers to utilize the potential of diversity. So when we help people creating positive diversity beliefs, then people can also identify more with more heterogeneous groups, which leads them to experience lower conflict because of less categorization. And this is a story we should tell. We should tell what we know about deciding when diversity leads to good outcomes and what people can do themselves to make the group better because of the diversity. Okay, we talked about context, we talked about process and composition, and now let's talk a little bit about process components. A common plan and purpose helps. This was one of the questions Michael West asked when in his research on the pseudo groups. Do you have a common objective? Do you know what the common and shared goal of the team is? The goals need to be specific. The team should have a high feeling of team efficacy. Yes, together we can do that. And my own research shows when people identify with teams, they also develop a sense of collective self-efficacy. Common mental models help. So you know that some teams are better because they have shared mental models of how to do things, and then they also have shared memory system, so that not everyone needs to know everything, but they need to know who knows what. Minimize social loafing, low levels of conflict. We will talk about conflict in a few weeks, and we talked about loafing, social loafing last week. Of course, we should, as managers, do everything we can to minimize social loafing by making the task more important, by making the group more important, by also having some individual accountability of the outcomes, if possible. Low levels of conflict, of course, overall we should have not too much conflict, but when we talk about conflict, we will also see that there are some situations or some conditions where at least a medium level of conflict can be helpful rather than harming individuals and teams' performance. If you were a manager and you had to set up a team, project team or cross-functional team, how do you do that best? And there are three main elements you can focus on. First, you can, of course, try to select the best people for the team. If you know that you have 10 departments and each department has one professor and you want to install a new cross-functional team working on the next master's program, then it's probably enough to have a selection of 4 or 5 or 6 of the individual professors and not everyone joining the team. And when you invite people joining the team, you may think about who has team player abilities. Who do you know has performed well as a team player and being open-minded and being tolerant to other opinions in department meetings before? If you create a new team with new recruited people, then you can do some tests about the team player activity or test for performance and then select them on open-mindedness on, as one of the factors. When we have an existing team or when we have people that we need to have in our team and we are not so sure whether they have the interpersonal skills that are needed, then we can train them. For example, we can send people to workshops in which they learn to better communicate or in which they learn to solve problems. And we can set up the reward system so that we encourage and combine collaborative efforts rather than at least only individual efforts. And we talked about this already. Maybe there are three questions we could ask as a manager when we are about to set up a team that help us deciding on, is a team the best way of getting this job done? Is the work complex? What is the complexity of the work? Can this job probably be done better by one person than by more people? If the job is too complex for an individual, then teams may be the answer. If individuals can get the job done very well, then probably teams are not the best answer. Does the work create a common purpose or a set of goals for the people in the group that is more than the aggregate of the individual goals? My initial example of 3 or 4 lecturers teaching in the same module probably does not require to have this common purpose. Writing a paper together with a set of 4 courses does require this common purpose, and here teamwork may be the better answer than individual work. And are the members of the group interdependent to achieve the goal? Or would they also achieve the same goal if they would work remotely, without much interactions, only at a certain deadline, delivering their pieces of their outcomes? Okay? Groups not only help people perform better, groups also help people cope better with stress. And there's, we have just submitted a meta-analysis in which we identified about 65 studies that on average show that strong group identification leads to lower physical and psychological symptoms, leads to more well-being and to lower stress and strain. And I would like to show you one small study that we have done quite recently, in which we wanted to see in an experiment whether groups would help people to cope better with stress. Did anyone hear of the TSST, the Trier Social Stress Test, before? Where did you hear about this? Yeah, in social psychology or? Which uni were you at? Hildesheim, yeah, sure you heard about this. So you were probably participants in the study that I show you now with Andy Moltzisch and Jan Holzer and. The Trier Social Stress Test is an extremely stressful task. I did the test myself in some pilot studies, and we measured our heart rate, for example, and the heart rate really goes up when you do the Trier Social Stress Test. So you are invited in the laboratory, and the first task you should do is give a public talk for an imagined job interview. And you are standing in front of a committee of two or three people, and all these three people do is looking very serious at you, and every time you say something objectively about yourself, they say something like, yeah, that's already in your CV, tell us something more interesting, please. And when people stop talking, they say, yeah, you still have 2 minutes, please continue. Yes, please? Yeah.
Yeah, and I was in the condition when I first entered the group and then had this interview.
I will show you the study in a moment, and everyone in this study, everyone was part of the group. And the next test in the Trier Social Stress Test is counting backwards in steps of 17, starting by the number 1043. And the only thing the committee is doing again is looking quite serious at you, and every time you make a mistake, they say, stop, wrong, start again at 1043. That's a very difficult task. We don't like that. I think you didn't like it, or you didn't like it?
No.
No.
Okay. I knew that they would not ask this question or would not be like so mean to me. They didn't have to.
Yeah.
So, but I heard of someone who didn't know the experimenter and who started crying.
Yeah, that's not nice. we have to. To do an ethics board approval when we do this study for very good reasons. But the Trier Social Stress Test was developed in Trier, and it's now the standard method worldwide to have a standard test of putting people under stress. And it's typically not so stressful that people start crying. And if they do, typically the experimenters are instructed to intervene and to interrupt the experiment and etc. But it's a standard measure of putting people under stress, and we measured people's stress by getting their cortisol responses. So this was done in Hildesheim. Here in Frankfurt, we have measured people's heart rate. We didn't find any effects for heart rate in Hildesheim. We got wonderful results for cortisol, and we were able to replicate the experiment with cortisol twice since we did this study. So the interesting thing, however, was not that we have put people under stress and then we measured with their cortisol response that their stress levels went up. The interesting thing was that we wanted to see whether groups help people better to cope with this stress. So we always invited students in groups of three into the laboratory, and then they did this task together, but still individually. So three individuals were standing in front of a committee, and then first the first person had to give this little job interview, then the second person and the third person. Then the first person had to count back from 1043, then the second person had to count backwards from 1048 to make it a little different, and then the third person, it was the third person's turn. And our argument or our idea was the group as such does probably not do anything to cope with it because it's still an individual task. Why should I feel better because there are two other people who have to do the same stressful task? Our reasoning was I only feel more safe, secure, might feel that I can ask people for their support if I feel a strong identity in this group of three. So by chance, randomly, we assigned half of the three people group to a condition of high personal identity, and the other half of the groups were in a condition of high social identity. In the high personal identity condition, we asked them to briefly talk about their individual differences. So we told them, you are all students of Frankfurt University or Hildesheim University, but you are still individuals. So talk a little bit about what distinguishes you from the other two participants. We took individual photos from them, and we gave them badges with individual names, like yellow, green, and blue. In the high social identity condition, we asked them, you are all students of Frankfurt University, so please quickly talk about your commonalities. What do you share? Then we took a group picture of them and we gave them a common name. They were all in the yellow group from then on. And this is what we found. This is the control group. Here's the Trier social stress test was applied in a control condition where people had to count upwards in steps of five, starting by the number one, and they had to give a very short presentation about something they liked without being assessed for a job interview. You see that there's very little responses in the cortisol over the 5 points of measurement, and there are no differences in social and personal identity. Yeah, there was no stress, there's no cortisol response, and therefore there's no difference in the experimental condition. And this is a Trier social stress test as I just described it to you. And this is a situation in which people were doing the test as a group, but didn't have, this is a condition in which they did it as a group, but didn't have a strong identification with the groups. There was no social identity shared among the group members. And this was the condition in which they shared social identity. And you see that we see a markedly lower cortisol response. So it's the same task, it's the same stressful task, but people who did this task together with two other people and who had formed a sense of shared identity were responding with much lower cortisol responses to the stressful task. And then we performed mediation analyses and we found that indeed higher group identification in the group condition of personal identity versus social identity reduced the cortisol increase and was responsible for the main effect of condition on cortisol response. So what I want to say is that groups are not only good for performing on a high level, sometimes we also join groups because we like them more and they help us cope with the problems that we experience at work. Groups put us in a situation in which we can attack management when we need to change the context under which we work. And a strong group identification buffers against stress that we experience. Some global implications are maybe in the United States, teamwork is less pervasive. Pervasive means frequent in all layers of society and all layers of hierarchy and all different industries. Because in the United States, people are much more told from early childhood on that it is the individual that counts and the individual outcomes. And therefore, maybe US Americans say that they are team players and that they like teamwork, but they are different from more collectivistic cultures in how they enact as team players. Self-managed teams may also be difficult to introduce on a global level, for example, because power distance problems. You can imagine when I tell people of a group of 10 people, so now you set your own goals and you decide how you achieve them, and you can also have some say about the budget or recruitment of new team members. This is not particularly liked in very collectivistic cultures with high power distance, where people don't want to make decisions as a group, but rather rely on an authority figure. Yeah, and team cultural diversity may create difficulties in the short run. I told you about our studies with ethnically diverse groups. So this is an especially challenging situation for managers when we bring together people from various ethnic or cultural contexts. Then we have to pay particular attention on the potential downsides, and we have to utilize diversity beliefs, for example, as one instrument to make diversity ending up with good outcomes rather than leading to conflict. This is, I think, everything for today. Have a nice weekend, have a great start of the next week, and see you on Thursday.